Welcome to the opening lunch of the Energy and Climate Track sessions of the 2008 Clinton Global Initiative. My name is David Sandelow, and along with dozens of other people, it's been my privilege to help pull together the sessions that you are about to see and many of the commitments that you are about to hear about. I want to start by thanking just a few of the extraordinary people who have helped to put on this session and this entire conference. And I want to start with our amazing advisory board. And if they're in the room, I'd ask them to please stand and be recognized, starting with General Wesley Clark, Abby Joseph Cohn, thank you, General, Shirley Ann Jackson, the president of Rensselaer Polytech, Van Jones, the founder and president of Green for All, Yolanda Kakabadze, Peggy Liu, the founder and chairperson of the Joint U.S.-China Cooperation on Clean Energy Committee, Wangari Maathai, Julia Martin Lefevre, the president of IUCN, Billy Parrish, the co-founder of Energy Action Coalition, and Carl Pope, the executive director of the Sierra Club. Thank you very much to all of our members of our advisory board. I want to thank as well the deputies who have done extraordinary work in helping to pull this together. We have a remarkable group of people, starting with two veterans of this conference who have contributed sage wisdom and advice, P.J. Simmons and Amy Christensen. If they're here, please stand up. Please give them a big round of applause. In my experience, between P.J. and Amy, you know everybody in the energy and climate change world. And two incredibly hardworking deputies who have put in 18-hour days. I can't thank them enough. David Spielfogel and Rachel Tronstein, who have done more than anybody else to pull this together. Please stand up. They're the ones who made it happen right there. So to those of you who are new to CGI, welcome. To those who are returning, welcome back. To the global audience watching by live webcast, welcome to all of you. CGI is two things. CGI is a spectacular set of conversations at the tables that you're at right now and also on the panels that you're going to see over the next couple of days in plenaries like we just saw. And how about Al Gore? Was he unbelievable with his remarks? Just incredible on this issue. And the other panelists as well. Just amazing. But CGI is much more than that. CGI is also all of the commitments that you have all been working so hard to bring forward, and that's going to be the topic of this luncheon. This luncheon is all about new commitments, and then promises made and kept. Because as CGI goes into its fourth year, this is about more than just new announcements. CGI is also about following through, delivering, and helping to make things happen. So to help kick off this discussion, I want to recognize a person who we are in enormous debt to and who my, in many ways, biggest thanks go to, and that is the sponsor of the Energy and Climate Track, who is a remarkable person. Who it's been my great privilege to get to know over the course of the past year, not just because he's an amazing person, but because, let me tell you, as his Winnie the Pooh tie today demonstrates, he's a lot of fun. Vinod Sekar is president and chief executive officer of the Petra Group and chair of the Sekar Foundation, which is based in Kuala Lumpur. At age 40, he is one of Malaysia's most prominent businessmen and philanthropists. Over the last decade, Petra Group has launched Southeast Asia's first commercial internet company, and brought a range of innovative technologies to market, including the world's smallest optical engine, which we'd be interested to hear more about. Today, Petra Group is working on a biotech, biofuels, financial analysis software, and a range of other technologies, including, most relevant for this luncheon, its subsidiary, Green Rubber, which is working on a patented chemical formula called D-Link. This technology is used to devulcanize waste rubber so it can be recycled and used again for a wide range of applications. Vinod is founder and chairman of the Sekar Foundation. And listen to these priorities of the Sekar Foundation. They are energy and climate, poverty alleviation, healthcare, and education. If that sounds familiar to anybody who knows about the Clinton Global Initiative, it should. Those are exactly the same priorities as the Clinton Global Initiative. I don't know who stole the intellectual property from each other here, but we're delighted to be sharing these priorities with the Sekar Foundation. Vinod was also the 2008 Grant Thornton Corporate Leader of the Year, and I'm delighted to be able to introduce you to kick off this luncheon, Vinod Sekar.
Thank you, Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very honored to be here. For those of you who attended the dinner last night, forgive me if I repeat myself. But looking at the quality of the participants and some other iconic figures attending the lunch today, I feel humbled and I feel somewhat like a fraud, but I'll muddle through it. Let me begin first by describing my company, Green Rubber, since they are the sponsors of this event. I think it's important you know what. You're probably wondering what Green Rubber is. It's not just the devulcanation of rubber. It's dealing with what we consider the world's main environmental hazard that no one really realizes or understands. So let me give you some figures. The world today throws away 1.3 billion tires a year. Every year, 1.3 billion tires are thrown in landfills, tire dumps, or burned in cement kilns. I think Al Gore spoke very clearly about burning. If burning coal is bad, you can imagine what burning tires is. All the dioxins that come out of what makes up a tire, it's not pleasant stuff. But 1.3 billion tires are thrown away, and it has a catastrophic impact on the world. Very simplistically, it affects the water table. It pollutes the water table. It causes disease, the spread of malaria, dengue hemorrhagic fever because of the Aedes mosquitoes, and many other things. And the problem is no one is using less tires. You can't stop it. As economies grow, as countries develop, there'll be more tires on the road, there'll be more rubber products in industrial machinery. So that's not going to go away. The problem has been what to do with it. 150 years ago, a man called Charles Goodyear created the process of vulcanization that heralded the industrial age. For 150 years, no one could turn that back. No one could reverse the process, and that's been the problem. I was lucky enough to have a father that actually was a bit of a genius scientist that came up with the basic technology. And as I mentioned last night, I just abused it. I'm the son that abused the father's genius. May have been a muddy along the way. but it's that process that's going to change the scope of things. I'd like all of you to understand why it's so important. I mean, 1.3 billion tires a year accumulated every year can't go on. Right now there are 7 billion tires in the world. Where is it going to go? For the most part, the industrialized nations transfer it out to the third world. And then it stays in some countries in Africa, in Timor-Leste, in many other countries these tires just get dumped. Or because land is cheap, they say, fine, you can't bury it in your country, bury it in ours. But we're just pushing this forward. And the situation is getting bad. And it's something that we have to do something about. And I'm hoping Green Rubber will play a major role in that. And I'm hoping that by December we'll be able to make a substantial commitment towards eradicating this problem with Green Rubber. So that's Green Rubber for you. But I'd also like to talk to you about CGI. And many of you here have been many times. But, you know, you're going to hear from individuals that have made substantial commitments that have seen them through. And I think that's what makes this organization, this project, so special. Unlike many other forums, this organization actually makes a difference. It actually has an impact. And it allows all of us to play a role, all of us that want to play a role, to play a role. It allows those of us that don't have the funds but have the ideas to reach out and get those funds. It allows those of us who have the funds but, you know, not many ideas to go pay for those ideas out there. And it encourages us. And that's something amazing about President Clinton. He's not here, but I'd like to thank him for that. He's at least allowed me to play what I think is an important role, and it makes me feel special, and I'm sure many of you do as well, just to be here. So I'm not going to go on and on and on. I'll stop here, but before I stop, I'd like to thank David Sandler. Where is he? There. I mean, this man's responsible for everything, and he's put an amazing show on for the past 4 years. So, you know, David, thank you very much. All right. And without much ado, I'd like to thank you all for being here and have a wonderful session.
I think she wasn't in the room when we recognized her earlier, but Wangari Maathai has now come into the room. And I have a quaint idea, whenever you have a Nobel Peace Prize winner in the room, you should recognize them. So, Wangari, a big round of applause. Those of you who look at your program will see that our guest speaker was Governor John Corzine, whose office called 3 hours ago to say, unfortunately, the governor is tied up with emergency business and unable to show up. That's about as bad as it gets for somebody sitting in this position. I'm a huge admirer of Governor Corzine, and he's got a real issue in New Jersey, so we understand. We are incredibly fortunate to have on site a person who is going to stand in literally at the last minute and give a talk, a person who is an amazing leader on this issue. John Podesta is somebody it's been my great privilege to get to know over the past 10 years, first when he was serving in President Clinton's White House, where he served as chief of staff with remarkable renown. He then went and founded the Center for American Progress, which has really established itself as a leading progressive think tank in the country. It is an amazing testament to John's vision, what that institution has become. John is also a member of the board, I think, of NRDC and League of Conservation Voters. You correct me if that's not right, John, and just a visionary on these issues. So I am thrilled on behalf of all of us to be able to recognize, as our opening speaker, to frame our discussion on climate change in the next couple of days, John Podesta.
Thank you, David. Actually, I'm on the board of the NRDC Action Fund. They don't even let me do politics. They don't, you know, I want to join the Mutual Admiration Society here, thank Vinod for all the work that he's done, and I want to thank David for his remarkable leadership in this track. I've been involved with the Clinton Global Initiative from its inception, and David's really, I think, made this really come together. He asked me to fill in for Governor Corzine. He also asked me to follow President Clinton and Vice President Gore. When I was in the White House, I always made a habit of introducing them and never following them. But I'll try to add a little bit to what the Vice President had to say. And then to kind of fill in for Governor Corzine, I intended actually to come here today and listen to him. I was hoping that maybe he'd help me with my 401k, which has become a 201k in the last week or so. But obviously, we're at ground zero of the financial crisis, and I want to come back to that after I say a few things about where we stand on the energy and climate crisis. And I do want to link up this track. David and I have talked over the years about the fact that this track needs more relationship and interrelatedness to the other tracks of the Clinton Global Initiative. It seems to me that the energy challenge that we're facing in this new century is extraordinary in its urgency and its scope, but also in its opportunity. And I think that I want to applaud the people who have made the commitments and what you're going to hear from them, because I think they provide the cutting edge of what we can see as the opportunity of trying to deal with climate change. You know, as I reflect on this, I think that energy has long been at the intersection of the economy, of the environment, of the national and of our national security. The availability and price of energy have always been important factors in economic performance. I think if you think about the fact that the traditional pollutants that came from the burning of fossil fuels really spawned the environmental movement in this country and around the globe. We've always thought of the burning of energy as an important environmental problem. And, of course, because energy has tended to come from places that are unstable over the decades and the need to secure lines of production of energy, they've always played an important role in our national security. But obviously, I think something is really quite different today than what we've dealt with in the past. The realities of global warming and our growing dependence, particularly on oil, much of it imported, we're facing that particularly here in the United States, make energy, I think, pivotal to all of those challenges, to our economic, our environmental, and our national security fortunes in the 21st century. I don't think that's just true for the United States. That's true globally. The president talked about the effect of the rise in the price of oil on the price of fertilizer, global food production, et cetera. These are interrelated and intertwined problems. So I think the challenge we face is nothing short of the conversion of an economy that's one that's sustained by high carbon energy to one that's sustained by renewable, low carbon, sustainable sources of energy. If you think about that, the scale of this undertaking is immense. Vice President Gore put out a challenge today to people in this country, which is in 10 years to move and convert electricity production to one that is no carbon based. That's a huge undertaking. It seems to me it also has enormous potential for our economy and for the ability of the people of the United States to come together in pursuit of that goal. And I think obviously that'll have a tremendous impact on people around the world. As I said, people around the rest of the world know that we're also living in an era of great insecurity. And the prices that I mentioned, we've seen haven't done much, I think, at least in the near term, to dampen demand. They certainly haven't in the U.S. Since January of 2001, oil prices went up 300%, U.S. petroleum imports increased from 53 to 62%. Overall consumption went up 3%. I think that's what the vice president was talking about when he said, we're losing ground. We're not really, meeting the challenge that is laid before us. In 2007, the U.S. spent $331 billion overseas to buy oil, 46% of our total trade deficit. I think that again, the entire globe is experiencing that. Maybe perhaps. Even in starker terms than the United States, because of the structure of our economy and the fact that over the last 30 years, with GDP growth, the units of energy in GDP are lower than they are, and certainly than in the developing world. For example, in the U.S., the effect on growth in the United States from a $10 a barrel increase in the price of oil, it's 10 times that effect if you're talking about oil importing nations of sub-Saharan Africa. Bono was here this morning. He joined with many people in this room, the Pope and others, to try to deal with debt relief and for the most highly indebted nations in the country. When I served in the White House, almost all of the effect of that debt relief has been wiped out in the last couple of years just because of the rise in the price of oil for those countries that import most of their energy. And I just came back from Rwanda. It's perhaps one of the most difficult problems facing that country, which is just the rise in the price of energy. So we face that really current here and now problem, but I think that the security challenge that the globe faces from its addiction to fossil fuels really pale in comparison to the direct security and economic challenges posed by global warming and that dependence that I talked about. We're already seeing the environmental effects of global warming with the extreme weather events, more intense hurricanes. Again, the Haiti example was mentioned in the first session. Increased cyclones, melting glaciers that are the primary source of fresh water for millions of people, increased heat and flood-related deaths from Europe to India, declining coral reefs, species pushed to extinction. I think we're going to feel the real national security consequences of global warming, including climate-induced human migration, increased food shortages, water insecurity, destructive weather events, spread of disease, and increased competition for natural resources. The Secretary General of the United Nations has pointed to Darfur as an example of what the future might hold and the effect of global warming that's had in terms of destabilizing Darfur and Eastern Chad. will also feel, I think, the direct economic effects of dramatically changing weather. Again, this isn't something that's 50 years away. This is in the here and now. According to the largest reinsurance company, Swiss Re and Munich Re, the number of big weather disasters increased fourfold between the 1960s and the 1990s, but economic losses jumped sevenfold and insured losses jumped 11-fold, and that's expected to double just in the next year's alone. The United States is currently reeling from the effect of Hurricane Ike on the Texas coast. And I think what we're seeing, and again, I think the Vice President underscored this, is most of you in the room know this, but global average temperatures increased about 0.8 degrees Celsius over the last century, and they're increasing at a rate of 0.2 degrees centigrade per decade since 1975. If the average temperature rises 2 more degrees Celsius, the Earth will be hotter than it's been in a million years. And that's what we're looking at over the course of the next, the next century. That's the future we're leaving to our children unless we make that massive kind of change that was discussed this morning. And we'll see, as I said, we'll see the effects of that, particularly on the poorest people in the globe. And that's what I want to relate to the rest of the tracks here. If you think about global development, if you think about the challenge of putting girls in school, if you think about the situation in global health, they're all going to be made so much more difficult by the results of the energy crisis and the global warming crisis. And, of course, the greatest effect, the greatest impact is on the most vulnerable people, the poorest people in the world, the people who account for the least of the problem. In Africa, for example, accounts for less than 3% of global CO2 emissions. Today, there are 2 billion people who live on the Earth without access to modern forms of energy. Many of those people are concentrated in sub-Saharan Africa. But according to the UNDP, drought-affected areas in sub-Saharan Africa could expand by 60 to 90 million hectares. So I think, again, if we're going to meet the challenges of global poverty, of the issues that surrounding particularly extreme poverty, of global health, we've got to do something to avoid the worst catastrophic effects of global warming. I saw my friend Antonio Guterres here earlier this morning, who runs the who's the High Commissioner of Refugees. We could be looking at a half a billion refugees by mid-century. As a result of sea level rise, as a result of food insecurity, environmental degradation, again, the loss of fresh water resources. And those tend to be concentrated in what we think of, I think, today as the most dangerous places on Earth. The Horn of Africa, West Africa, the Middle East, all the way to Bangladesh, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Indonesia. That's why I think climate change, in my view, is the most demanding problem confronting the world, confronting our political system. It's getting at least some attention, I think, in the current debate, in our own political debate. Certainly the issue of energy is front and center in the debate. And I think, the world's changed at least to some extent in that both candidates for high office and as President Clinton noted, both Senator Obama and Senator McCain will be addressing CGI. At least they've focused on the going forward challenge. They have some difference of view about how we meet it, but at least they're it's become a front and center issue for both leading candidates for the presidency. And I think that we are, fortunately, the United States, I think, is poised because of that change in attitude, because of that change in leadership, because of the involvement of the business community that's represented here, in becoming a leader once again on making forward movement in the world. I don't think we can ask anyone else to deal with with the challenges that the globe faces until we once again become a leader. And as I noted, I think the private sector in our country has led the way. We've seen that happen in state governments in particular. So I'm relatively optimistic that the political system will respond to this challenge, that we won't repeat the experience of the last couple of years where we've lagged behind, but can become leaders. And I think with that we'll bring freedom, both diplomatic, military, and economic, from global warming pollution that allow us to focus our resources on the other big challenge that CGI looks for, to create coalitions of peace and progress and attacking the profound problems such as poverty and disease. As I noted, Governor Corzine is not here because he's dealing with a financial crisis. And I think President Clinton put this on the table this morning. Are we going to be now, come January, put in a position where we say, well, we can't, one more excuse, we can't tackle this problem because we now have $700 billion we're putting into the to stabilize the financial markets. We have a deficit that's $400 billion this year, growing next year without even the consequences of that financial bailout. Are we going to be put in the perspective or will our political system be stymied once again and say that we can't really affect change, we can't move towards a system where we're going to make the right sorts of investments to be able to produce the kinds of profound change that need to be done by the private sector, but they need government policy and they need to be government-led? My answer to that would be we can't afford not to. Vice President Gore talked about what the downside consequences of ignoring this problem were. I would say we can't afford not to because it's the only circumstance that's really going to create the virtuous circle of investment. And again, this dialogue took place, I think, in our first plenary. This is where innovation will happen in the U.S. economy going forward. I think you see it in terms of the investment picture that's happened over the last couple of years. This is where job creation is going to come from. This is where new industries are going to go. This is, if I travel a lot around to a lot of universities and talk to a lot of young people in the country. We have a big campus-based program at the Center for American Progress, and actually the person that runs CGIU was stolen from us to run CGIU. That's a grudge I'm still holding. And I think if you talk to young people in the country, this is where they want to apply their energy. This is where they want to apply their intellectual capital. This is where, you know, a decade ago, if you went into an engineering department or you went into, you know, first of all, it was hard to find anybody going into science or engineering because they all wanted to go to Wall Street. They may have second thoughts about that. And today, it's I think people profoundly understand that this is where they want to spend their creative energy. And I think this is where, again, this is where a place where that can really power the economy forward, that could create that virtuous circle of investment and innovation. And I think CGI pointed the way with the idea of making commitments, and that's what this panel is going to celebrate, how we create the energy, the movement towards creating the new technologies, the new industries, the progress that we need. Last year, my organization, the Center for American Progress, pledged to work with Mayor Cory Booker, the mayor of the city of Newark, on a green summit to try to put together a plan to take one of the oldest and a city plagued with poverty and violence and turn it into shining light for where a new economy could go. Along with partners, the Apollo Alliance, Green for All, and others, that summit took place over this year. The city has hired a sustainability director. They held the summit this September. Clean energy and a green strategy are being written into a core of the master plan for the city of Newark and the economic development strategy for the port, for open space, for job training, for green building. It's I think Mayor Booker's vision about where new jobs can come from and where people can be taken out of poverty. The coming economy has to be green, solving global warming problem, just as this investment takes place in an older industrial city like Newark, which has infrastructure, it has skilled workforce, it has great assets. So I want to applaud the work that the mayor's done. We were glad to be a small part of trying to help provide some intellectual capital for that. Now we've got the climate solutions, green jobs, and a green economy, I think, coming together. And they align with the future and not with the past. They're really pointing the way to make that happen. The utility was involved, PSG&E, local community leaders, the universities, the state of New Jersey. They've really seen the energy opportunity as a place to make a difference. And so in this idea that David talked about, that people are making good on their commitments, I think there's going to be a video, and then we're going to have the panel talk about the commitments they made and the success that they've had. Thank you.
Thank you, John. That is absolutely extraordinary. This man is a hero for the planet. Let's give him another big round of applause. Production team, can you run that video of the Newark commitment that John just described? Thanks.
Commitment is an important one for the United States. I'd like to ask Mayor Cory Booker from Newark. The Newark Green Future Summit will bring together the nation's leading experts on green energy and sustainability to create a roadmap for sustainable development. And I predict to you it will be the most effective part of his economic development strategy.
I live every day thinking about a larger vision of my city that is really a green vision. It's about looking at everything from the ports, a large one we have in here in the city of Newark, to recreation, to jobs, from a green perspective. And suddenly, it expands our imagination.
Newark is well positioned to become a model sustainable city for the 21st century. This region is expected to grow by over 18 million people in the next 20 years, and Newark is so well positioned to capture that. It has amazing transportation access. It's on the Passaic Riverfront. We're a dense, compact city. And right now, one of the things we're doing is creating a citywide master plan to ensure that that growth is captured in a sustainable way.
And the common theme is really green jobs, that are career track jobs in green industries.
Most of these jobs build upon existing job skills in construction, maintenance, manufacturing, and landscaping that are already present in the Newark workforce.
What the green economy is promising is that these are going to be jobs where there are career pathways.
We want to build green buildings and build them sustainably, but we also want to employ people in long-held profession trades that give them opportunities on this project, but for future employment.
It's amazing what a powerful impact a safe green space can have on children, on families, on a whole neighborhood. By reclaiming our city parks,
revitalizing the city parks has also been shown to bring increased job capacity for the city of Newark and training the youth as well as the adult community.
We believe that we could reclaim Newark land, parkland along the river, but also brownfields, and make them part of a viable port economy that cuts down some on the global logistics chain, that saves money for companies, that creates jobs for our workers and business opportunities for people in the city of Newark.
I feel as though if Newark is going to grow, the economic viability of this community needs to depend on the port. But in order for the port to grow, we need to ensure that the health of our community is also protected.
The future is going to be green, and this is a chance for kids in Newark to be part of that, to make a choice to really build their own healthier, more sustainable future.
Every element of our city urban life, from health to economy to recreation to education, all of these elements touch upon this idea that a greener Newark, a greener America, is the larger, richer definition of a prosperous Newark and a prosperous America. This is what we seek.
I'm gonna keep looking at those because that's amazing. In the hood, You can grow sunflowers.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our panelists. Lou Hay, Chairman and CEO, FPL Group. Richard Kaufman, CEO, Good Energies. Mindy Luber, President, Ceres. Peter Gutman, Global Head Renewable Energy, Standard Chartered Bank.
Thanks, everybody. Before we get started, I just want to say that we have a few people who have been working for the past year on that newer commitment in the room, and I want to recognize them. And Chelsea Albuquer, who is in charge of this for the City of Newark, please rise. Amy Christensen, Bracken Hendricks, from Center for American Progress, and if there are others from the Apollo Alliance or Green for All, just please give them a big round of applause for what they're doing in the city of Newark. So our theme today are commitments and a call to action and promises made and kept. And you have here four people who have made commitments in prior years at Clinton Global Initiative, and I can tell you about what they've done and what the role of the Clinton Global Initiative has been in their work. Before we get started, I want to make a point, commitments are exciting and commitments can be empowering. Commitments can also be difficult. And we're going to be discussing over the course of this lunch and I think over the course of the next couple of days, follow through on commitments and recognizing exemplary performance in following through on commitments. But I think we also want to recognize the real challenges sometimes in following through. And there is no shame in having made a commitment, worked to try to get something done, encountered roadblocks, and not quite get as far as you thought. You know, none of us here are dealing with easy problems. We're dealing with tough ones. So I think we ought to celebrate successes. But before we even get started, I want to just highlight the fact that these are tough problems, and we ought to recognize that as we go forward. So with that, I am delighted to turn first to Lou Hay. Well known to anyone in the utility industry in this room. Lou Hay is the CEO of Florida Power and Light Group. He has had a long, distinguished career at Florida Power and Light in the utility industry. FPL is the leading provider of renewable energy in the country, I believe, Lou. And Lou's going to tell us about the very significant commitment that Florida Power made last year at CGI and what they've done since.
Well, thank you, David. And one of the reasons we really like the Clinton Global Initiative is not only do we get a chance to talk about what we're doing and talk about the importance of climate and other matters, but it is a place where people take action. And at the end of the day, we know it's action, not just words, that matter. And despite what you said, we do take our commitments seriously, and we know the Clinton Global Initiative is going to hold our feet to the fire. And I think that's what makes this a very, very powerful and very different organization. Last year, we made a commitment. It was three parts. The first was to build 500 megawatts of new solar power in the United States, including 300 megawatts in the state of Florida. The second was that we were going to invest $500 million in smart grid technology in our regulated utility in Florida. And the third commitment was that we were going to introduce a program that would guarantee that for anybody who purchases renewable energy credits from our company, that 100% of the money would go towards brand new renewable generation. Not a penny would go for admin or anything else. So we're very excited about that. Let me fill you in on where we are on our commitment. And I'll point out our solar commitment. Because these are big-scale projects we're talking about, do take a number of years to build. And we weren't really sure how we were going to make this happen, talking about the challenges of it. But I'm pleased to say that we're really ahead of schedule on all three of our commitments, but particularly the solar commitment. As I said, we committed to building 500 megawatts of solar. In Florida, we worked with our governor and our legislature, and we have already filed for permits and received PSC approval for 110 megawatts in Florida. We have all the sites worked out. We'll be breaking ground we have three different sites. We'll be breaking ground on one of the sites before the end of the year and the other two in the first 2 months of next year. We also have, outside of Florida, in California, filed for all of our permits, procured the land, so on and so forth, for 250 megawatts of solar generation in California. So we're well on our way. That's a total of 360 megawatts of real, honest-to-goodness projects that are on their way and very much approaching the 500 megawatts that we committed to. And I want to put this in perspective. I think a lot of you know that we're the biggest wind energy producer in the world. A little over 10 years ago, we only had 500 megawatts of wind. Now we have 5,500 megawatts of wind, and we're growing that very rapidly. So I believe that this is just a starting point for us on solar, the 500 megawatts I've talked about. I see no reason why we can't end up having a portfolio of solar generation that's as big, if not bigger, than our wind portfolio. But, you know, we start small. Small, 500 megawatts isn't that small, by the way. It's probably an order of magnitude of a $2 billion commitment. But you know, we're not going to stop there. On the smart grid technology, we now have roughly 100,000 of our customers equipped with smart meters, and we are well on our way to we've proven the technology. There's a whole host of things that had to be worked out, but we're moving along on that, and we expect to have all 4.5 million of our customers equipped with this technology in roughly a five-year time frame, which will help our customers save on their electricity bill by being more informed and using the energy in a much more intelligent fashion. The third area that I mentioned was a consumer program for renewable energy credits. That's taken a lot of work. There's a whole host of things I'm not going to get into in the details here to be able to assure our customers that, in fact, this will be sort of called a lockbox, a trust fund or whatever, but if they buy a renewable energy credit for us, they can be assured that all the money will go to even more new renewables. We plan on launching that program early next year, but it's well underway.
Thanks, Lou. Congratulations on all that. Lou, I want to put right out there a question that in different forms I get a lot and just get your reaction. What you just described is a big commercial investment. You did this to make money, and, you know, let's hope you make lots of it doing this. You didn't do this for the opportunity to stand on stage at CGI alone. So
I have a few friends here.
I'm sure that's great. What role does CGI play in all of this for you? Has CGI been helpful to you in the opportunity to stand up there? And any thoughts for those who are working with big commercial investments and CGI's role?
Yeah, David. CGI actually was very helpful. Somebody earlier asked me today, well, were you going to do all this stuff anyway? And, you know, we're big in renewables. We really have been focused for years on, you know, trying to reduce our climate footprint. But no, these were not things that we were going to do. And when we heard about CGI, frankly, the first thing I wanted to do was take some of the stuff that we were doing in wind, because we're building over 1,000 megawatts of new wind every year. Put that in perspective, that's about a $2 billion per year commitment. Hopefully it will even be more than that in terms of money that we're putting to work. But David and his friend said, no, you can't count that because you're already doing that. So it really focused our thinking in terms of what else could we do above and beyond what we were already doing. And that really got us thinking and led to our commitment. But just as importantly, it's not just making the commitment, it's delivering on your commitment. And I haven't heard anybody talk about this before, but CGI was incredibly helpful to us in the progress we've made so far, and for two reasons. One, because of the publicity, because of the involvement of everybody, you know, from stars. Last year, Brad Pitt was here, to all the dignitaries involved and all of you involved. It just created enough impetus and enough publicity that it really rallied my team to really make this happen. But just as important as rallying my team it helped to rally the people, particularly in the state of Florida. We got a lot of publicity. Governor Crist was with me last year, and with his leadership, it really helped to grease the skids, if you will, in the political process, because we couldn't do some of the things we're doing in Florida without legislation. We had a legislation passed earlier this year that helped make this happen, and it's just amazing the momentum that was created because of everything that goes on here. So it was incredibly important to us, David.
Well, thank you, Lou. Well, let's hear about a different type of commitment. And this is a commitment, by the way, which I've had described to me as President Clinton's single favorite commitment, with apologies to everybody else in the room who's made extraordinary commitments. Richard Kaufman is CEO of Good Energies, the world's largest private investor in renewable energy. Richard was previously a partner at Goldman Sachs, where he was chairman of the Global Financing Group, a member of the firm's Partnership Committee, Commitments Committee, and Investment Banking Division Operating Committee, has an extraordinary record of leadership in finance and in renewable energy. And Richard, tell us what your commitment was last year.
I guess I'm one of those young people that decided to leave Wall Street and do something else, but maybe not so young.
Good timing.
So we invest more than $500 million a year in renewable energy, mostly in solar and wind projects and investment in renewable energy and efficiency technologies. But that's not our commitment that we made. Our mission and our motto is power for a better world, and we're not going to have a better world if everybody's seen that picture of the world at night and half the world is dark at night, and as John said, 2 billion people don't have access to basic energy. So that's the area that we wanted to focus our commitment on. A lot of people have had the idea that solar would be a good solution for this problem, and a lot of people have observed what happened with mobile telephones and how mobile telephones in the developing world leapfrogged the grid, the wire grid, and so perhaps the same concept could obtain here. And there have been several efforts to try to achieve that objective, and frankly, most of those, in fact, everyone that we looked at had failed. The technology works initially, but if you're going to provide lighting, you need batteries, you need some amount of maintenance, and what would happen is that within a very short period of time, you had solar panels, but no light. So we approached this as an investor, and we wanted to find a social entrepreneur and a new business plan, even though this was a not-for-profit commitment, to see if there was a better approach. And I think we found one, and we'd like to share it with you because I think there are some lessons that that are valuable to other commitments. So the first slide. This is Ethiopia. John talked about Africa, so this is Africa. I don't want to say the grid will never get to this part of Ethiopia, but it's going to take decades for that to happen. These are tukul, which are typical houses. This is a very, very rural, poor area. Next slide. So this is lighting. It's kerosene. Whatever electricity is broadly in most parts of Ethiopia, and again, most developing countries, is diesel. It's obviously extremely expensive and has environmental impact. So what made this project successful, in contrast to the projects which have gone before, are several things. Just in the interest of time, I'll talk quickly about three things. Next slide. The first slide here says that the community has to, as a group, ask for this. The coal community needs to be involved. And this was actually a community that, after they heard about what had happened at another community where this had been a successful project, turned down a donation for a diesel generator from a development agency to take on this, to ask for our project doing solar, even though it was going to cost them a little bit more money because they liked what this was going to accomplish. So you need the community commitment. The second, next slide, please. The next thing that makes this work is the personal commitment. I guess we learned something from CGI here. Each person that's going to get one of these units has to make a commitment that they're going to put aside the amount of money that they would have otherwise paid for kerosene to pay for a battery replacement. And this person is signing with pen. We have many contracts where it's just a thumbprint. The third slide, or next slide, please. The third thing that makes this work is, running ahead of my notes here, is that we have developed a school for electricians and technicians, and we actually make some of the manufacture some and assemble some of the solar materials. And next slide. And so we install local people install and maintain the equipment. So what do we get? Next slide. I'm sorry. And so this last point here is the installation. This person's getting a book, and that book, at the same time they get their get the system installed, is the payment book where somebody's going to come along every month and collect the money. So it's a microfinance bit. So next slide, please. So what do we get? At night, we get small-scale businesses. You can see this is somebody with a sewing machine, but there are small stores that are open. Next slide. We get people going to school at night. And this is adults that otherwise are working during the day. There's also schools for children that, again, in this community, can't go to school because they're working, drawing water. Next slide. This slide here, for those that are familiar with Where's Waldo, you'll see a familiar face there in the center, President Clinton, who visited this project in Ethiopia just last month. So I just leave it here just to say that thousands of people now have power through this project. We believe we have a model that works. It's right now just in Ethiopia, and so we'd be delighted to have other partners participate because we think we have something now that could be rolled out to other parts of the world.
Thank you, Richard. Big hand. Thanks. And Richard, just to be clear, what the Good Energy's commitment here was financial resources and technical advice as part of the commitment?
Yeah, that's right. So we wrote a check, and we have definitely provided both money as well as technical advice. Okay. Yes.
So in addition to businesses coming to CGI and individuals making commitments, we have NGOs who come to CGI to make commitments. And Mindy Luber, the president of Ceres, has made and delivered on a very interesting one. Mindy is well known to anybody working in this area. She leads Ceres, which is the leading coalition of investors working on and environmental leaders working to improve corporate environmental social governance practices. And she also directs the Investor Network on Climate Risk, which is an alliance that coordinates U.S. investor response to the financial risks posed by climate change. Mindy, tell us what you did.
Right. I'm going to talk about two things, but I'm going to first pick up my microphone. How's that? Any better? I'm going to talk about a few commitments, but I'll wrap them into a holistic conversation. And what's interesting to me about this panel is we are all approaching it from a different way. I came as an NGO. In some instances brought partners, in some instances found partners because of the Clinton Global Initiative, but it's because of partnership that has made substantial programs grow. So for me, when I think about the Clinton Global Initiative and what it has meant to launching and moving programs of change, which I'll talk about very briefly, one, it's partnership. Two, it is about levers of power. I mean, you bring here levers of power, people from finance, from the corporate hierarchy, from government, and we're able to bring people together to really tap into the right places to have the right impact, and I think that's terrific. Three is it's a place that people are willing to redefine issues, think about things in different and unique ways from a number of different perspectives. And four, it is about results and systemic change. I mean, I feel every day, if I can't report back to you on the kind of progress we made, I'm not going to want to be at that next session. So hold our feet to the fire. It is a good thing. I'm all about trying to get results. And the Clinton Global Initiative is a framework for building those partnerships, getting some of the oddest bedfellows into the same room, and I'll talk about them, to make substantive change is part of the great success story. So thank you, David, for all that you've done. One quick one, and this is about partnership, levers of power, and change. We look at climate change as a financial issue, a fiduciary issue, a risk issue, an issue that has to be dealt with at a corporate board level, at an investor level, as a risk issue. I mean, think about it. 2 years ago, insurance companies weren't using their 300-plus risk assessors to look into the future for what are their risks in payouts. John talked about inordinate payouts and liabilities to the insurance industry. Now they are. The issue partially coming out of this has been redefined as a fiduciary, as a financial, as a risk issue. And I want to flag one thing for us all to be thinking about and then quickly talk about the projects. The credit risk that we're seeing, or the so-called subprime risk, and people could call it whatever they want, that was a risk we should have known about. It was not brain surgery to know and to understand that we were giving out mortgages like lollipops on street corners to people or businesses or entities or institutions who didn't quite fully recognize the risk or have the ability to do that. I would argue that climate risk is not a far jump away from it, both in the terms of we know it, but we're not acting on it. We know it, but we're ignoring it. And the magnitude of it is breathtaking. We only need to listen to Al Gore this morning and talk about the magnitude or what John just said and so on. So thinking about this issue in the perspective and merging it, as David said, with the other tracks that the Clinton Global Initiative or John said is brilliant because these things are completely interrelated. But a couple of the commitments just quickly to talk about how we've been able to leverage things because of this entity and this enterprise. One was, sounds like a simple thing, but climate change should be viewed as a governance issue. It should be debated at the highest levels of corporations, that being the board, because it's a fiduciary issue, both a fiduciary risk and opportunity. And in my judgment, when things are debated and decided at the level of a board and accountability systems are put into place for the CEO and the rest of the enterprise, no matter how big or small they get done. And the odd bedfellows, and not so odd, frankly, but the partnership that this initiative brought together. Ceres was able to work with three different entities. One, a world-leading academic institution, Yale University. Two, a major corporate player, Marsh McLennan, or Marsh, the division of Marsh McLennan. And three, a smaller family foundation, Jesse Fink's Foundation. But to bring together philanthropists, corporate leaders, NGOs and academic institutions to build a sustainability program. We pledged to train 200 corporate board members. We have gone well past that. But more importantly, at every major institutional discussion now where they're talking about what is good corporate governance, it's no longer being discussed as just do you have the right audit committees and is there a separation of CEO and chair or is there the right executive compensation program in place. We are now seeing 23% of corporate boards and multinational companies looking at sustainability issues, holding their CEOs accountable in specific, including salaries being tied to it for issues like climate change. We are seeing some of the largest institutional investors like CalPERS and CalSTRS, whose assets total $450 billion, now redefine when they analyze a company and decide, is that company managed well? Are they practicing good governance practices? They are not only looking at audit committees. They are looking at climate change and the impacts and the effects and what is the plan and what is the practice and what is the policy. And I would say that that would not happen without the partnership we built and the launch of the Clinton Global Initiative. I'm going to mention one other. My problem is we've had several over the years, and that's been a privilege. I'm not going to put you through all of them or the future announcements. We've got to deliver on them before we talk about them. But just one other. We talked about another lever of change, that being the owners of companies, the institutional investors who own some of the largest companies here in the United States and the world, and challenged each other at the Clinton Global Initiative to build a network of $1 trillion worth of institutional investors who will act on climate change. Well, we've now got it to $7 trillion, and it's $7 trillion worth of asset managers and institutional investors who are engaging with companies who've changed the practices because they're owners of the companies. They're not activists. They're not trying to make the companies lose money. They want the companies to build their share value. But with their voice as owners, they've been able to move several dozen companies this year, file 57 shareholder resolutions to be dialogues, not campaigns. They've petitioned the SEC to make sure that there is a mandatory requirement of climate risk in the formal business filings, the MD&As and the 10Ks, because these are real material risks. And those very same investors are pushing their Wall Street money managers to analyze climate risk. They're scrubbing their own portfolios. They've invested $2 billion in clean tech and have made a commitment to $10 billion more. It is about those partnerships, those levers of change. They work here, David, and thank you for giving us the opportunity to work with you.
Thank you for everything you've done, Mindy. So at Clinton Global Initiative, we are constantly saying it's not all about the money. We are constantly being described in the press in terms of the billions of dollars that our commitments represent, and we emphasize that there are many, many other hugely important metrics, lives saved, kilowatt hours, saved, new renewable energy put online, that type of thing. All of that said, we don't object when people come forward with multi-billion dollar commitments. And so last on our panel here, to talk about what the Global Bank Standard and Charter did is Peter Gutman, last year, by way of a commitment, is Peter Gutman, who's the Managing Director and Global Head of Renewable Energy at Standard and Charter. Peter is responsible for the bank's renewable energy business. Before this, he was CFO at Video Networks, a London-based technology company. He has a background in investment banking, including years as a Managing Director at Goldman Sachs. Peter, tell us what Standard and Charter did.
Thank you, David. I guess some of you may know Standard and Charter better than others, but for those that don't that well, it's a leading bank in the emerging markets of Asia, the Middle East, and Africa, and it's been operating and financing growth companies for the last 150 years. So it's spent a lot of years in and out through the ups and downs, and is quite familiar with the areas. It's one of the perspectives we bring to the table in looking at the climate change issue is, I guess, the serious engagement that everybody in this room, I think, feels, but it's also our core markets are substantially exposed, and if the issues aren't dealt with and CO2 emissions aren't curbed, they can be truly devastated. And so for us, it's a real risk to the business that we, as we look in the out years or maybe the nearer-term years, but it also creates a commercial opportunity in the context of financing renewable energy and companies in the low-carbon area. So that's really sort of shaped some of our thinking about it, and I'll talk about the commitment in a minute. But it's also, I think it's useful to put in context as we look at our markets. They're projected through 2030 to represent 75% of the new CO2 growth. And so that's a significant issue and one that has sort of a political context to it as well, because when you look at per capita numbers are different than absolute and whatnot. But, it's a large component of growth, and it's 60% of the global population. And on projections out through 2030 again, it looks like these markets need 60% of the projected $10 trillion in investment in new energy infrastructure. So there's a big question about how much of that is renewables. Additionally, the areas of solar and wind, where I think we, like most, are spending a lot of time now, are resource-rich in this area. I guess everybody knows those areas get a lot of sun, but I guess when I first got into the space, thought wind was probably evenly distributed. Turns out North America is wind-rich. It's about a quarter of the wind energy potential is in North America. We're focused on markets outside that. So if you look at the wind energy potential in our markets are roughly 50% of global wind energy potential, ex-North America. If you look at solar potential, our markets are about 60% of global solar energy potential. Not that you can harness everything, but there's a big opportunity there. So bringing that to the table, and I think the bank, I've also been very impressed about how they've approached the markets over these years and really have made, even before the Clinton Global Initiative, had been looking to give things back, but I think also and thought of themselves as a force for good, but it was really kindred spirits, it seems, in the way coming together in the context of Clinton Global Initiative of creating a stretch, large number goal to say, can we actually do something like the commitment we made last year, which was to play a lead role in financing $8 to $10 billion in renewable energy projects over 5 years. So that also makes you, that's a big and exciting challenge to be part of, but it does, it's sobering to figure out, okay, how are you going to organize yourself to do that? And so what we have been doing up till now really is we've been a lead senior bank lender in project financing for renewable energy power generation. And in that context, we've worked pretty aggressively, and we've done about $1.4 billion in lead roles in renewable energy in our footprint and another $1.8 billion in Europe. And that's across, so that's Asia, Africa, Europe. It's solar, wind, geothermal, run-of-river hydro. The projects we've been involved in will reduce emissions by about 2 million tons per year. And so that's a good start. But I think one thing that it's, again, as we work through this process, and, you know, it's different than a normal business planning process internally. When you get up on the stage here, you do, you know, you want to be putting your best foot forward in front of an audience like this and a forum like this. So I guess we're working very hard to think through how we organize ourselves, and we're looking at not just power generation now and not just debt financing, but playing up and down the supply chain. We've been very active doing that in solar already, as well as beginning to look at opportunities where, you know, we're putting a significant amount of debt on. Are there also opportunities for us, because we get pretty close to early stage projects, understanding how you might invest in some of these growth opportunities, doing a little bit of advisory work, as well as raising equity. So anyway, that's all on my plate, and, you know, in part thanks to this to work through that. So I guess in closing, I think we really think our footprints are critical to the global solution that we're all working for of transitioning to a low-carbon economy or energy sector, and that we're well-placed to facilitate technology transfer, to work on the financing side and across the piece, really. And it's a great forum to interconnect with like-minded people and hopefully, you know, find help.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks for everything Standard & Chartered is doing. We're about out of time. I want to close by talking about one final commitment, and in doing that, I would ask you to all look above you, where you will see compact fluorescent light bulbs. Those of you who were here last year will recall that they were incandescent, and we had lots of complaints on that topic, and so as we left, the Clinton Global Initiative staff committed to work with this hotel to try to change that. And having been involved in some of this, I can tell you it wasn't always that easy. The hotel staff is fantastic, but encountered a variety of technical and specification problems in doing this, partly motivated by this conference and follow through, worked very hard with us on this. And I just want to recognize a few people who were really instrumental and gave great technical advice in helping make this happen, starting with Greg Katz of Good Energies, who's one of the leading experts on this topic. If anybody is interested in building energy efficiency in this room, find Greg Katz, who's somewhere here. Please stand, Greg. Warner Phillips, if he's here, who has a great light bulb product we've been working with. The entire deputies team of the Clinton Global Initiative operation here, Amy Christensen, PJ, Rachel, David, as well as our deputy emeritus, Michael Terrell of Google, who was very helpful with this. And finally, the staff here at the Sheraton, Jack Keddy, I think, is here somewhere, the general manager. There he's in the back of the room. Thanks for everything you did with us on this, for working on this. So many, many thanks. And a big round of applause for our commitment makers here. And our ending energy waste session will begin here at 2 o'clock. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. The lunch session is now concluded. Your next workshop begins at 2 p.m.